Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the FreeLap timing system, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the SpeedMat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The FreeLap timing system has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right, welcome to episode 34 of the Just Fly Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Smith, and today the show is going to be a little different. We're going to be having a question and answer based off of user questions on social media and then the best answers that I have to give in that regards. It's been a while since I've sat down and actually talked out answers to things. I used to do it on YouTube back several years ago. I enjoyed doing it, but ever since I started the podcast particularly, there's really hasn't been too much of a need for it. I've had amazing guests and I've been able to answer some of the questions I've had for them and a lot of things that I've always thought about in the field. It's always exciting to see what, despite all the articles and all the podcasts and everything out there, what questions people still have. So I'm always looking forward to that. I would say definitely of all the fields and all the means that I threw out the ask me a question, Instagram was by far the most popular. It kind of almost shows you where the social media is turning. Obviously, I think Facebook doesn't make it extremely easy for business promotion when you don't have an exciting picture and just says, hey, ask me a question. At least not compared to, say, 3 or 4 years ago. But really excited to do it. We got about 10 good questions from a variety of different people. So I'm going to give you guys my best answers for these things. Let's start with, we had Citric O'Toole on Twitter. He said, from a strength perspective, is a double bodyweight squat and deadlift enough to maximize the single leg vertical jump? Okay, cool. So this question here, I'm really excited to answer it just from the perspective of talking about what makes a single leg vertical jump. And so before I get into the yes or no, I'm going to talk about, well, what makes a great single leg jump? And that is utilizing elastic energy effectively along with coordination. Okay, when we talk weight room strength, especially in, say, a squat and even a deadlift to a degree, we are talking about the ability to get into a very disadvantageous joint angle, the bottom of a squat where the knee is bent to probably 130 degrees or so, give or take a few, maybe even more, 140, 150 if you're really going rock bottom, okay? And at that point, the skeletal structure of the body and the tendons really can't do a whole lot in terms of getting you out. You have to use the muscles, okay? And particularly the muscles of the glutes and the quads. The hamstrings don't play a gigantic role when you're down there. Deadlift, similar story, but not entirely. You're gonna get a little bit more hip flexion in this case. And I would actually say a deadlift is almost closer in regards to what's happening in a single leg jump. But even still, there's a huge, huge premium on the strength and integrity of the spinal erectors, you know, as well as the glutes and hamstrings, no doubt. But you know what? If you have amazing glutes and hamstring strength and your low back is crap, you're not going to have a big deadlift. Even your upper back, although I will say too, some people purposely round their upper back in deadlifting to shorten the moment arm of their spine so they can lift more weight, which is cool if you're a power lifter and lifting more weight off the floor or you want to impress your friends or whatever. But in terms of sport, that type of thing has zero transfer, probably negative transfer, okay? So bottom line is heavy lifting in disadvantageous deep positions, competition standard competition standard positions and jumping really high has fairly little correlation, especially on the high, like the medium to high end. On the early end, anything works. I think especially deadlift, probably having a little bit more of a transfer there. And any deadlift too, like in higher variety. So sumo deadlifting, standard deadlifting. I can even give you a story from my own athletic background. When I was 16, 17, I was doing the Science of Jumping program, and in it they had recommended 4 sets a deadlift, and like the deadlift is the ultimate lift if you want to jump higher. And so you sold me hook, line, and sinker. So here I am doing deadlift, and the first day I go down to do it, which is, this is really, does not speak highly of me as a strength athlete at all at age 16, 17, but even with 135 pounds of regular deadlift, I felt myself rounding my back. It didn't feel good. Maybe it was a little more, maybe it was like 155, but it was not a lot of weight. And this was a guy I could already dunk at this point, deadlifting like maybe 200 with bad form. So that shows you how much the direct transfer is there. But I just went sumo and did sumo deadlift for a while, really liked it. It put me in a better position. That and all my plyometrics got better, and everything went up in tandem, and my jump improved a whole lot. And I do think the sumo deadlift was helpful. I always felt like after a good session, there was some potentiation. I felt pretty good there. However, deep squatting, I always felt like I actually had a negative correlation with my own single leg jumping. I remember my senior year of college, or senior year of high school, sorry, it's so long ago at this point. I took a strength and conditioning class, and it was the first year or whole semester, I should say, where I did like heavier deep squatting the whole semester. And what I noticed is my two leg jump was going up, up, up. Like every week, it seemed like it was going up an inch just because there's specificity there. But it seemed like every week my single leg was actually going down a little bit. And at the time, I could care less. I was playing basketball, and honestly, for the point of basketball, in many ways, I would take a double leg jump over single leg just from a perspective of, unless you're a huge, you know, fast break player slasher type, which I was not. I was more the roughhouser. For me, a double leg was huge, and I was really happy to have that improved. And interestingly enough, though, after maybe three weeks of getting away from deep double leg squatting, my single leg actually returned pretty quick, and then some. It was actually even as high or higher as it had ever been after I got away from that double leg squatting for a while. So in a sense, it probably actually set a nice base of sorts for me. But I typically, for high jump athletes in particular, and even horizontal jumpers, I usually don't prescribe a whole heck of a lot of deep squatting. I'll do it for, you know, I would say the front third of a cycle, I'll usually do it. So if you're, general physical prep or the front third of indoor or the front third of outdoor season, I think it's good to do it for the hormonal perspective and general muscle and somewhat tendon conditioning, but I don't think it doesn't have that high of a transfer. And then the higher level you get, the less important it is, really, like as you become more elite. I've heard of really good jumpers who do utilize it. I just don't think the transfer, it's not worth really fretting about. So, and it can even be negative at some point, especially if you just keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it, and you never get into half squats or quarter squats or speed half squats or just ditch it. It can be a negative factor. So, that being said, is a double body weight squat and deadlift enough to maximize the single leg vertical jump? My answer is yeah, it is, and then some, and I wouldn't worry about it any more than that strength for single leg vertical jumping. And a lot of people have awesome single leg jumps at 1.75 squat and even 1.5 squat. There's people who can get up really, really high off one leg. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. Okay, next question. So Godfrey Ilafabari, hopefully I pronounced your name right. So, and sorry if I didn't, because I know we talk all the time. So Godfrey wants to know, dunking every day, what's up with it? And how about a 1 foot jumper specifically for dunking every day, for obviously for jumping as high as you can? I mean, that would probably be the question as I have written down in front of me. So good question. I know we all have maybe read the article I posted on interview with Jordan Kilgannon. I think we posted it about maybe three, four years ago now. It's been a long time, but he really rose to fame in the dunk world several years ago. One of the things that he had said that he had done, he didn't really lift a lot of weights or do a lot of plyometrics. He just dunked every day and he wanted to be the best. And so that was that. And there's a lot of similar stories in other other skills and types of athletics, things like that, especially maybe calisthenics and bodybuilding. But when we're talking skills, if you want to get good at something, you got to get reps in, and you got to really myelinate those nervous pathways, and you got to put the time in. So, I mean, yes, you need to get volume. Is dunking every day the best way to do it? Well, depends. First, let me talk about just general thoughts on that, and then let's talk about 1 foot jumping specifically. So, for a lower level athlete, yes, if you even can dunk, maybe if you can dunk on an 8 foot rim. So, low level athletes, novice, maybe even some intermediates, is doing some sort of jumping and dunking every day if you want to jump higher, good or the best situation. I think, yeah, to a degree, it is. And if nothing else, it's to get you in the mentality of what's the most important thing you're doing. I think that it mentally, the idea that, oh, what's this training program I have to do? What should I be doing in the weight room? What's this plyometric that so and so is doing? That why am I not getting better because of these exercise selections? Just to mitigate that mentality and kind of help, I think help in that regard is really important. So in dunk for dunking every day. But once you get to the intermediate and advanced and elite levels, dunking every day is obviously not going to work because at some point you're going to have to rest and recover. And now Jordan Kilgannon in the interview had mentioned, when I wanted to jump really high, I would just stop. I would dunk every day for a while, and then I would just stop, and then I would supercompensate and go to a competition or whatever, and I'd jump, be jumping really high. And so in that regards, he actually was not dunking every day. It was almost a self-fluid periodization of sorts. And I mean, really, that's what it's all about. As we're looking at periodization and what is this thing we call periodization, it's not MapView, it's not the textbooks, it's not the fancy graph. Everybody has a little bit different response to things. And just to write the whole year down in cycles and waves, and I'm gonna train this many times. Not that people do that for dunking, but I almost put dunking in a track and field slot because it's very similar. And nobody does that and has the optimal performance out of every single athlete. Things change, responses are different. So you need to have things be fluid. In one sense, dunking every day can be like that because if you're feeling good, do more. If you're not feeling good, don't do as much, or work on different types of dunks, or dunk on a lower rim. Even that could work for a while. But once you get to a particular level, you're going to run into a few plateaus, and there's a few reasons for that. And that would require probably not dunking every day for a few reasons. One is obviously you need to supercompensate at some point, which even obviously Jordan, who popularized the method, did. So, but we're talking maybe like planned recovery or dunking 3 times a week or 4 times a week or 2 times a week. Eventually, you're going to have to get to something like that to be able to supercompensate to the point where each session is higher quality. So, no doubt you're going to have to not do that at some point. To the extent of how often, well, just depends on the person. Some people are built, if you're really built for jumping, you're really elastic, and maybe you're not super fast twitch, you could probably jump and dunk pretty often. If you're a fast twitch powerhouse, super dopamine type, and you're probably not going to be able to dunk that often before you start running yourself down. So it's kind of, it depends on type, how often you can do it. 1 foot jumping specifically, compared to 2 feet, I don't know. I would say my gut would say probably less chance of being able to dunk every day if you're a 1 foot specialist. Reason why, 1 foot is harder on the joints. It's, in 2 foot jumping, you get to kind of mitigate or spread out the force between the two legs, and you're not going to reach as high peak joint forces and stressors. And in 1 foot, you get a lot more just jamming of the ankle and the hip and eccentric forces on the knee. And our bodies adapt for survival. So if you're every day going out and putting pretty significant heavy forces on the hip, knee, and ankle and the tendons and the joints, well, how do you think your body's going to adapt if it wants to survive and not get hurt? It's probably going to adapt by not letting you jump any higher and adapting to survive by adapting to being able to handle a lot of jumps very often. If you want to jump very high, you probably have to jump less and infuse a little bit of creative variability, as well as some different types of jumps and a lot of general strength to get your best effort or best result.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Okay, that almost kind of brings us to the next question, which Godfrey also asked, which is getting over a speed and power plateau, specifically in jumping. So I'll kind of piggyback off of a few things I just mentioned, which was basically you need to eventually rest, okay? And another thing too is you may need to just take a two-week break, a 1 to 2 week break after every, say, 3 to 4 month period of training. We need to renew our adaptation reserves. If you look at how Bondarchuk does his training cycles, he'll do his developmental cycle for, say, 20 to 40 sessions, which is, I'm not 100% sure, but around about, 6 to 8 weeks, 5 to 9 weeks, maybe somewhere in there. So they're going to train for that till they exhaust their adaptive reserves on the given exercises. Then they have to rest for like 10 days or maybe a little bit more until they get to the next cycle. And if you don't rest long enough between cycles, you mess up the next cycle. You mess up the adaptation pattern in the next cycle. Your body needs time to get its adaptation back. Now, in Bondarchuk's training, clearly they exhausted the adaptive reserves they had for the last cycle. So you have to renew those. But generally speaking, in any like speed and power pursuit, there's a lot of stress that goes on in getting better, especially once those gains slow down. So at some point, you need to take a little break. And in those breaks, the biggest thing is the removal of the special exercises, so no plyometrics, no specific lifting. Generally, what I've had good success doing, I do this in the vertical ignition program, is just very general weightlifting, body weightlifting type things. In the Bondarchuk program, I believe they do light implement throwing, so nice, easy throwing. But there's no special exercises. That's the stuff that beats you up the most. So you want to take away all that stuff, and to keep with the continuity of training, you want to keep something in. So, for example, you could do 2 weeks of low rim dunking, and just and not even trying particularly hard on anything like jumping really high, just something fun, something that's still jumping or dunking, or just play basketball for 2 weeks and don't worry about dunking. And do kettlebell stuff and do kettlebell goblet squats and kettlebell swings and all that stuff and some windmills maybe, or maybe even a Turkish I'm not going to bring up the Turkish get up, but I do Turkish sit-ups. I haven't jumped on that get up train. I know it activates as all the core muscles, but I don't know, it's just too much for me. Okay, so that's a good way to do it. Another way is you're looking at like strength and power alternation. The better you get, the higher up the chain you get, the more you want to look at alternating maximal strength and maximal power blocks. Man, I just had an awesome kind of interview with Coach Anilio Mora from Brazil, and he was talking about, and he's coached multiple Olympic gold medalists. He's been a big influence in the way I've kind of done my own training schemes, just in terms of reading what he's written and watching some of his videos on the UCoach website. He's been a huge, huge impactor on what I've done. And so Nelio talks about, he goes going 6 weeks of strength and 6 weeks of power in the last interview article he did. Tudor Bompa, who's kind of the, Matt Viev's like the father of periodization, but Tudor Bompa's a guy who really popularized improving on that model in classical periodization. His book was one of the first I've really read, and man, I loved it. It kind of impacted a lot of what I did in college, and obviously I've moved away from some things. I don't believe in a hypertrophy phase, not that I even ever really did one, but a lot of his stuff was really good. And he had mentioned that as you move higher and higher in the ranks, you have to start looking at alternating these strength blocks and power blocks and strength and power and strength and power. So a lot of it's just that alternating strength and power. The higher up you get, the more you have to alternate some of these high intensity training means to get to where you need to go. You can't do the same thing over and over and over again. Some people can, but they are few and far between. So yeah, that's something to definitely look at. You can experiment with the ratios a little bit. Other plateau busters are eccentric training. Obviously, easiest with something like a K-Box. Otherwise, you have to have a couple buddies around, but that could be a nice plateau buster using context. You have to have good work capacity to handle that. Also, look at stuff like French contrast. Look at tweaking your motor pattern, which I mean by that, I mean dunking on different height rims or maybe even a different size ball. You know, dunking on a 9-10 rim, dunk on a 10-2 rim, use a volleyball, use a soccer ball, dunk a 2-pound medicine ball. Find new ways to challenge yourself from an external perspective. So if you're jumping over people or cones, or try jumping, you know, set a cone out and try a particular dunk from, you know, the distance between that cone and the rim and move that cone in or out, you know, do some variation. That's really important to improve skill acquisition. Okay. So also, another big thing, and maybe this is cliche, but don't just look at what you're doing in your sport. Improve something else. Look at your nutrition. Look at your recovery. Look at your sleep. Find a low-hanging fruit. How many athletes ask me questions online, I think of sometimes, but how many of these athletes are looking at what they're putting in their body every day or how many hours of sleep they're sleeping? Sometimes you just have to look there first. Last but not least, maybe talk in terms of how different athletes respond. Like if you're not a super elite, super fast twitch guy, which I know you're, Godfrey, you're pretty fast twitch. I mean, shoot, you could dunk better than I ever could. So you got to have some fast twitch muscles. But people who aren't like, even jumpers who are high level, some still respond decently to this stuff. But like a 2-minute drill every 2 weeks or so, I think can be a good thing. And by that, I mean like try dunking, try starting at the free throw line, go dunk, then run back to the free throw line, then run back and dunk again, or the 3-point line. And do that as many times as you can in 2 minutes or even like a minute and a half. And I wouldn't say do that every week because that will build up some lactate. And some people do best, like a slower twitch athlete could do that maybe once a week, maybe even more. A middle of the road explosive, maybe every other week. And some athletes, probably not at all. but you might want to try that every other week. Last thing. Look at doing more things in what's called, or what InnoSport called the anaerobic 2 capacity, which is around 30 seconds of solid work, give or take a few seconds. So that's kind of in the same spirit of that 2-minute drill, just because if we do everything in that 7-second alactic world, we never really build capacity to enhance that, you know, short burst, single jump mechanism. So finding things to do in that 30-second explosive world is good. I also like 30-second isometrics on various lifting drills can be cool. But yeah, like a 30-second drill with the same vibe as a 2-minute drill can be cool. 30-second continuous jump of some sort, that can add up to capacity. So don't underestimate that. But also, if you're playing basketball, you're probably getting a lot of that stuff, which is why basketball is awesome. And I think completely underappreciated by many coaches in the things that it provides to athletes. Okay, next question. And that was a little bit of a long-winded answer. Man, that was like a, Godfrey, man, that was like a loaded question, dude. So we're already pretty far into this thing. So I'm going to try to get to a lot of these other questions that you guys had. I know there's quite a few of them. Okay, so talking about top-end speed training with more advanced athletes. Okay, so the more advanced you are, and that was triple jumper 38984. So thanks for that question. And so here's my answer for that one. Is that the more advanced you are, the more you need to sprint to get faster. I guess simple as that. I guess a very common answer, probably not, maybe not very insightful on my part, but I think that in becoming an elite athlete, you need to look at all those things that are in your training program and the thing you need to improve the most. And so if that's top end speed, you need to look at the ratios of everything in the program, you know, jumping, plyometrics, weightlifting. And you need to say, okay, if I want to improve my top end speed, maybe I need to, obviously I need to sprint more, but maybe I need to cut a little bit of lifting over here to make that happen. Because to be honest, top end speed, your fly 10 and your deep squat in some ways are almost a little diametrically opposed. I know that answer might not make everybody happy, but to hit those peak conditions, at least, you have to make some cuts in some areas, at least for a particular point in time. Outside of that, I think some of the best things that I like to do in terms of building top end speed, you got overspeed, obviously, is great. If you have a 1080, then you're in a good place. Some of the controlled overspeed there. Wickets and mini hurdles are awesome. Working on technique. So one thing I like to do is watch an athlete's technique just doing a fly 10, and then do that same fly 10, but do it over wickets or mini hurdles and note the difference and see what you are capable of. If you're capable of the right technique, putting the mini hurdles in the right spacing usually puts you in that right technique. But some people who just don't have those muscle firing patterns, those reflex loops, are a little anthropometrically not suited for that high end velocity or whatever through their muscle balance. You throw hurdles in there and they still don't look that great. And then you realize you have more work to do. So a lot of it too is finding technique, which is a whole podcast in and of itself. But just kind of to wrap that up, like in a concise format, it's you have to look at the whole program. You have to start giving more credence to speed, more time to top end speed. You're probably going to have to take out some more just force work in terms of like heavier lifting. You can still keep a little bit in there, just probably not like deep squatting so much, maybe more like half squatting, like eccentric half squatting, K-box, maybe a little bit of single leg stuff. Reactive single leg stuff is good. I like reactive oscillating split squats in that regard. So you can do that. Then hone in on sprint technique. Like look at people who are running really fast, and hopefully people who are running really fast who are about your height and have a similar build to you. And what do they do? And obviously they might be anterior or posterior chain dominant. Obviously that plays a role, but try to get a feel for what they might be doing that you aren't doing, and do that in context of flying 10s. I think flying 10s really are that like key performance indicator for being fast. And you have to measure it. You have to find a way to measure it to get really, truly better at it. Or at the very least, racing people in top end who are also running really fast. Or you can go longer. You can go 80s, 120s, 150s. Just find something where there's a solid outcome that gives you a good handle on where you are at. Then hone in your technique, mini hurdles, all those types of things, and it'll help you out.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Next one. Keith Snyderman, thank you for asking this and talking about training older athletes, master's track, vertical jump. How do we train older athletes in speed and power? What are some considerations in that regard? I'm only 33. I'm kind of a baby in the personal experience of training older athletes, but through online training, I would say actually half my clientele is probably in that upper 20s to mid 30s range. And I also even work with some master's athletes and work with several athletes in their 50s. And even in your 50s, man, you can totally improve, or maybe not improve what you do when you're 25, obviously, or 30, but you can do well. Like you can, there's a lot of good that is still left. I think the charts show that fast twitch muscle starts dropping off at age 30. Yes, very sad, I know. But it kind of maintains itself. It can maintain itself into your 30s with proper training. And I would say lifestyle and nutrition is a big part of that. And by the time you get to your 40s, it's probably inevitable you're going to start dropping a little bit. But so what are some things that you can do to maximize that as you go along? Well, just from my observations of different athletes, we got like Justin Gatlin and Kim Collins and these people. And from the people I've seen who are great shape and can do these great speed power feats as they get older, I'll say there's a few things. One is make it fun, like play. You have to find a way to make it playing and make it fun. And you got to stimulate that dopamine to make it enjoyable. I mean, imagine doing, unless you're like, you know, a Thomas the Train Engine type person, athlete, it's pretty hard to do the same thing over and over and over and over again for so long. And just with making it fun, I mean, like you're recreating the joy when you were first doing this stuff. I remember, I think it was in, I feel bad because I don't remember the exact book, but it was talking about Pele, the soccer player, and how Pele before games would like do this meditation, this visualization, and he would visualize himself as a young player and just the joy that he had when he would get out on the soccer field. And I think it's that joy that's so important to keeping things fresh over the years. Even when I get on the track now, I always find myself thinking, visualizing when I was 20, 21, and getting out on the track and just loving it And I think that's really important as we go through this thing we called sport and aging. So that's a big one. I think you need to train with young people. Find a way to train with young people is huge. Like, I love having interns or assistant coaches training with me at work is huge. I will go to a point where my vertical jumps about 3 to 4 inches, my bench press, everything goes up. Just training with someone younger, it's extremely invigorating, and it's really important. Another thing, and I get this from Dan John, is compete. Find competitions. If nothing else, you're going to meet new people and have great conversations, but I don't think we ever really can get away from finding something to compete in. There's just such power in that. Outside of that, maybe more mechanical training things is obviously we need to train less. You know, a lot of people might, I've heard of a lot of like these 30 somethings Olympians who they train like 3 times a week and the other days are nice and easy. Maybe they'll go for a trail run or just hang out. So yeah, train less. I think that's a pretty common thing. One thing that I believe that I think might be maybe less, I don't know, like this is like the anti-Rocky thought. If you watch the Rocky with Sylvester Stallone, he was in his 60s and he wasn't as fast as he used to be, but he was strong, and so he was really gonna use his strength. And I don't know, maybe for boxing that's okay. I don't know. I'm not a boxer and I'm not a fight coach, so I can't say much there. But we lose fast twitch muscle as we age, and you can still stay strong. You can have man strength as you get older, and that's cool. But the thing with strength training is you can be strong with a lot of slow twitch muscles. And if we're trying to adapt to be fast and strong in our 30s and 40s and so on and so forth, and we only have a limited amount of adaptation available, and we want to keep our soft tissue in as good of a state as possible, and we want to keep our tendons compliant in the right place, my contention is to do a little bit less strength training. I mean, don't not do it, but it's not, I think we should do less than what we got away with when we were younger. I remember Vern Gambetta on the Gaincast, which is excellent, talking about no athlete probably at the end of their career was like, hey, I should have lifted more weights. I didn't lift enough weights. I don't think there's that many athletes who reach the end of their career and have that mindset. So I just think that trying, and plus two, it helps us not to get in that. If you want to be fast, you want to be explosive, it's very easy to get in the rabbit hole of doing a lot of weightlifting simply because that's the thing you're still good at, which is cool. Like, it's still good, cool to be good at that. But just don't get so caught up in it because you're good in it. It will start to eat away from your fast twitch. And so you got to get out and sprint and jump and do it with young people and do competitions and take care of yourself. I mean, hopefully we're older and we can afford therapy or find someone to do therapy on us and those types of things. So I think that just becomes all the more important as we get older. And health is always number one. If we stay healthy and we're able to do it, that's obviously really huge. And then, obviously, this is something that I think I've learned. And just as I push forward as both a coach and then still an athlete at heart, is all those other low-hanging fruits. So stress and nutrition. And you look at these people who are in their 40s and 50s and in great shape, and a common denominator is just an amazing commitment to putting the right things in your body. And usually it also is accompanied with a great daily routine. But I know our carbohydrate metabolism definitely slows down in the mid to late 20s, mine did. And my goal, definitely, I'm like, well, shoot, I'm probably not going to jump as high as I did when I was 21. But maybe I could be a little bit less body fat. You know, maybe I can... I think my physique can still be good because I put better things in my body and I take better care of myself. So all that stuff I think is just great for people who are in the upper levels and are trying to still stay fast and explosive. And that fast twitch, man, it is the fountain of youth, and I will be trying to sprint till the day I die, or at least doing something related. So great question. Thank you there. Okay. I got a bunch of questions on Instagram from LEG32. So we'll try to hop through these real quick. I know it's kind of getting long on this podcast here. First, why do I get better in jumping within a session, but not session to session? Okay, so I start jumping and I'm training, and in one day and I jump higher throughout the session, but then I get to the next session and I don't jump higher. The reason why is because within a session, something called potentiation is happening, which means there's multiple things. Your nervous system is firing, sending faster signals to your muscles. Your calcium channels, or your calcium is getting through the cellular membranes faster. A lot of things are happening that are allowing your body to get warmed up and potentiated so you jump higher within that session. But what happens when you finish? Well, all that stuff goes back to baseline because you have to rest and recover and go on with daily life. And so obviously you're not going to walk into the next session with those, nervous signals firing real quick and the calcium, flying through the cellular membrane and all that. You got to warm up again. It's just physiology. Okay, but session to session, obviously as well, your body goes through this alarm phase and adaptation phase. And so you can't necessarily, and remember, your body is bent on survival as a first priority. If your body was not bent on survival and just adapted to everything, let's just say your body adapted to every single session and said, okay, we want to jump higher, let's do it. And just imagine you're jumping 1 inch higher every single session, every single time you go into the gym, say every 3 days. Well, in a year, you are going to be jumping, 300 inches higher? Okay, so that's a pretty stout vertical. Just imagine the joint forces in that 30-foot vertical or whatever it is. Just imagine the forces on your joints. Now imagine that you are a caveman in the jungle and you have the capability to jump 10 feet in the air, 15 feet in the air. Do you think you're going to get hurt? Yeah, probably. Something's going to pop. Something's going to go. You're going to land weird and twist something, and then a tiger's going to eat you. And then you will not be there to send your seed on to the next generation. So your body's in this constant survival mode, and it's going to try to keep things to a point that is safe to adapt to. So that's, I guess, long story short. So how do you obviously improve session to session? Well, you have to be structurally ready. You have to be able to land properly to, if you're going to jump 48 inches, your body needs to be able to land that 48-inch jump. It's about slow cooking things. You got to realize it's like the nature of physics. It's fractal. It's not a linear line. So you're going to go up and you're going to go down and you're going to go up and you're going to go down until you basically reach that highest point that your body can safely jump. So there's a lot of things going on. There's skills, there's physiology. Too much for the scope of this. But long story short, that's why you can jump higher within one session, but session to session, not the same thing. Okay. Next question from same guy, LEG32, shin angle in step-ups. Should it be parallel versus far forward? We can talk split squats too here, okay? So basically, if I'm doing a barbell step-up onto a 12-inch box, should I try to do it with my shin parallel to the ground, like a single leg jump with momentum coming into it, like maybe you've seen on jump videos? Or should I try to really like dorsiflex my ankle and have my knee far forward and step up that way, like a Peterson step-up a little bit? You could say the same thing for split squats or lunges. Should I do lunges with my thigh parallel like the trainer told me to, or should I push my knee forward? It totally depends on what you want to train. Are you trying to train ankle mobility? Are you in a sport that requires agility like soccer or basketball? Or do you want a high jump? Or are you a 400-meter runner? It just totally depends on your sport, man. If you are a high jumper and you or a single-leg dunker, or even a 400-meter runner, and you're trying to get this insane ankle mobility that you don't see in your sport, what do you need it for? I mean, you, and in trying to do a lot of movements where you're getting that mobility and you're really stretching those tissues, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to kill you as long as you're not doing a ton of static stretching and there's stretch under load, because static stretching and stretching under load are two different things. If you stretch and then that stretch is followed by a contraction, that's a different story, so that's cool. I don't know that there's that much bad that could happen from that, but from the training programs I've kind of seen from people who are really good, like at the top end speed and single leg jumpers and all this stuff, I don't really see a lot of like deep squat stuff in their program, because it's not like needed. On the other hand, you got team sports and things, and knee injuries are related to ankle mobility. Agility is really related to ankle mobility, and change of direction, all these important things. So yeah, then you should be doing things with a lot of dorsiflexion. I will say though too, even just regular sprinting, there is a little ankle rocker. So when I'm doing like when I'm coaching split squats or isometric lunges, I usually coach the knee right over the toe, just to get that little bit of dorsiflexion. And I think that's fine for either way, whether you're a single leg jumper or double or sprinter or whatever. And then if you are doing an agility based sport, you might want to look at doing things with a larger ankle rocker component. Okay. Next question. Good drop catch exercises in the weight room. Okay. And they also mentioned that beside kettlebell swings. So good question. Kettlebell swings, by the way, too. Kind of cool is I've heard Dan John and others talk about how when people start doing a lot of kettlebell swings, they start jumping higher. And I mean, we, you know, a lot of us, the old guard, or I don't know, you might think, oh, well, the kettlebell doesn't weigh a lot. It's all in this like functional world and balance world. And, you know, it's dumb and it doesn't overload enough and all this. And, but a kettlebell swing is a drop catch, basically a hinging drop catch. And it's not even about the power production so much to me as the skill. And it's wiring in that skill. And it's wiring in that release, contract, release, contract. And a lot of athletes don't have that in the hinge. And they get it from the kettlebell, they jump higher. So simple as that. So what are some other things that you can do? I like drop catch RDLs. I use that a lot for athletes who might not be at a point where I think Olympic lifts are going to help them a whole heck of a lot. I don't really do a lot of drop squats. I'd rather do like a full catch clean or a power jerk, but I think those things have ramifications for two leg vertical jumping. I like drop split squat stuff for sprinting. I think that's pretty helpful. I think that's pretty good array of things for trying to improve various skills and tools. I will say though too, some people who are just really truly built for their event of choice may not need as much as an athlete who isn't. So it's not a coverall for everybody, but those are some things I like. Next question from LEG32. How do I get a better broad jump? And I already have a double body weight squat. So question of this, the squat isn't helping you. I think it was actually Brett Contreras' research that was showing that hip thrust had a much higher correlation to broad jump than squat, because again, it's a hinge, right? So you want to add in kettlebell swings too, man. That's explosive hinge. So some special exercises, forget about your squat weight, look at your deadlift, look at hip thrusting, look at like kettlebells as some special exercises, practice broad jumps, repeated broad jumps, and so on and so forth. I think it'll help you out.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Okay, next question. We actually already talked about ankle rocker, but question, ankle rocker relationship between force and stiffness. Okay, so... Good. This is a good one here, man, because there's been, like, I've heard in the past, like, track coaches not wanting their athletes to squat deep for this very reason. They wanted to keep the ankles stiff and resilient, afraid that deep squatting like Olympic weightlifters and whatnot, would ruin that stiffness and that reactivity, because your knees have to translate very far forward to create this this movement. So, to tell you the truth, I've just never, like, athletes who I know are never going to get in those positions and it's not important, I just don't put them there often. Like I mentioned, I put them there a little bit in like the first third of training cycles, but it's not in a huge volume and I've never really noticed too big of issues. And if they just don't have the ankle range of motion, I'll elevate their heels in the squat and that's that. It's not a big deal and I don't think it's really going to hurt them. But team sports, yeah, you gotta work on that. So force and stiffness, though, I think I'll just leave it kind of with what I said. It's a little bit of speculation. Well, I guess if you are a basketball player and you need good ankle range of motion, I mean, I think you can. I mean, you look at some of these positions at the ankle that someone like Michael Jordan got into when he's blowing by a defender. His ankle is like the angle between his foot and the ground and his shin. So the ground is one line. His ankle is the center point, and then his knee is the other line, or the other point. I mean, that angle is like 35 degrees sometimes. I mean, it's insane. So his ankle is really mobile, and those tissues are compliant enough to let him get there. And yet he also is amazing at jumping off one leg. I mean, guy dunks from the free throw line. So obviously, yeah, it's possible. But Michael Jordan, I'm sure that the guy probably wasn't stretching all day to get to that level. I can tell you that he has strength in his lower leg that allows that. Okay, so Just as long as I think you aren't doing a lot of static stretching to get there, I think it's okay if you're going to do mobility-based work. Yeah, doing things like step up where there's a contraction that follows the stretch, and it's a shorter stretch. I saw something too that was kind of cool in the world of stretching at the Track Field Consortium 4. I saw Dan Fichter talking about watch the animal kingdom and watch the animal stretch, but it's not like a static stretch. It's like, you know, a few seconds. They'll stretch out, they'll align the fascia. It's just for general mobility, but they don't leave it that long. Even when I had my, I have a daughter who's 6 months old, and just watching her when she would stretch in the morning, she, you know, just instinctually, you know, stretching her arms out over her head just for a few seconds. It's something that's built into us, so I don't think it's like a terrible thing. Just as long as you're not just hammering on a stretch, you know, you don't see a cheetah just hammering, stretching its hamstring out for in the wild for a minute. So I think as long as you do that, you're probably okay. Okay. Finishing up here, we got a question from DZO89, exercises that strengthen the ankle complex. So this is a great one because, man, it's really important to have a strong ankle complex. JB Marin talked about this in an interview we did back multiple episodes ago in the podcast. That was also just an amazing piece. And he was talking about just how important it is to be fast, to have strong ankles. And he recommended high rep, like basic single leg jumps or double leg jumps that were high enough reps to really get those ankle muscles work, because the muscles in our lower leg are pretty resilient. Like, they have to deal with a lot of walking and just a lot of loading over and over and over again. So it takes like a lot of reps to get them worked. You know, what's funny too is I think they studied the calves of like 400 meter runners, like elite level. And the calves of those runners was actually like way more slow twitch than you would ever think, just because how many steps are those guys taking in their workouts? And when it comes down to it, the efficiency in running and sprinting is largely about the energy transport through the Achilles. So kind of makes sense. So I think it's okay to go higher reps on that stuff. I think single leg, I think using different surfaces is huge. So hopping, I like the Russian like slant board where you're hopping from one angle to another. Do it with single leg. Once you work up there, double single leg ankle, that stuff is great. I'll tell you something I learned from Chris Corfus too, one of the best sprint coaches I know, and always just, he's always like learning new stuff, and I always learn new stuff from him, and it's awesome. And he was just, him and I were just chatting the other day, and he was telling me about a great version of this, is that is lining up a, so standing on a surface barefoot, and then put a AirX mat. You kind of have to start on an elevated surface, so like a 2-inch rubber block, and next to that 2-inch rubber block, put an AirX mat. So your surface and the AirX are on the same plane, and then hop back and forth barefoot between the two surfaces. And it's just a great way of making the leg muscles just continually, they can't get caught in one rhythm. They have to continually make that phase transition of landing on the unstable and going back to stable. And it's just really good for ankle motor control and stability. And so that's an awesome one that Chris told me. I'm super stoked to try it out. He had mentioned just some great gains his athletes had been getting from that. So that would be a cool one to try out. And thanks to Chris for mentioning that with me. Okay, last question of the podcast. And man, this has been a little longer than I had expected, but it's just been great getting all these questions from you guys, and I hope I've been able to help you all out. And so Mark Collins wants to know this for your podcast question: pusher or puller, when looking at an athlete sprinting, how can you accurately identify the features to determine whether they are a pusher or puller? Also, Mark goes on to say, I'll read the whole question too. How important is it to identify this, and how can it help determine exercise selection and appropriate training cues? Okay, so also at the Track Field Consortium 4, I had the great pleasure of listening to Stuart McMillan talk on sprinting and strength training for sprinting. And man, it was some of the best, I think it was 4 hours worth of presentation, but it's one of the best 4 hours I've spent listening to one. And he had talked a little bit about how to identify a pusher or puller. And his one of his thoughts is, obviously you can look in the weight room. If you can squat a lot, you're probably a pusher. If you can deadlift a lot, you're probably a puller. But looking at a sprinting perspective, is an athlete have really good front side mechanics? Is most of their sprinting in the front? If so, they're probably a pusher. They're probably really good at utilizing their posterior chain to build that negative foot speed down. to the track. If they're a pull, if they're a, or sorry, if that that's if they're a puller. If they're a puller, they have good front side mechanics. If they're a pusher, they probably don't have quite as good a front side mechanics. They don't get quite as good negative foot speed, or the negative foot speed being like at the apex of the knee drive. How fast can you get that foot hammering down to the track? A pusher doesn't get isn't as good at that as a puller, but once their foot is on the track, they'll get into their quads a little bit more and push the ground away from them. So it's a little bit different running style. And once you watch sprinters long enough, you can start to see this in action. So, and this should probably correspond as well with whether that athlete kind of prefers to deadlift or and clean or squat. And I remember my first experience with this was in the biomechanics lab at Wisconsin La Crosse. There was a guy who was a NCAA finalist in the 200, really good long jumper, and he had run like 21.2 in the 200. And I remember talking to him about his lifting, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I squatted like 450 or something, and but I only cleaned 220." And this guy was a big time pusher. And you can be fast being a pusher, but it's just a little bit different ball game. Generally, we when we think of sprinting and top end and really good top end form, we generally think of good pullers, people who can get that good knee drive and really rip that through. But in reality, there are. I mean, you can't. At some point, you can't turn one into the other. Someone's natural strengths is just how it is. And so in terms of how important is it, I think it depends. I think that you can't really change one into the other. You can do a couple things. You can, one, look at balancing them out in early training periods just to prevent injuries and just give them a few different motor options and things like that. But once those athletes are in periods where they need to be really fast and competitive, they need to focus more on their strengths. So a lot of this naturally works itself out with the way modern strength and conditioning kind of assesses weaknesses and things like that. But I think that's kind of a way to approach it there. I think whatever they are, eventually they need to train to their strengths to some degree. And then Stuart had actually mentioned this, and I just thought this was incredibly insightful. But talking about how you cue them from a kinematic perspective, what do they respond well to? And he had mentioned that pushers seem to respond better to cues that had to do with putting force into the ground. And it makes sense because those athletes are very good at, once that foot hits the ground, putting force into it. Whereas pullers seem to work better with cues in space, maybe what are your arms doing or things like that. I hope I'm not butchering what he said, but it made sense to me when he mentioned it. I thought that was the first time I had heard anything like that, cueing based off how an athlete moves. So that was really cool. So yeah, it's almost like maybe when we're talking kinetics versus kinematics. So kinetics being forces, if we're talking about those athletes' forces, I think at some point we just kind of got to let it be and train them how they move. Kinematically, look at cues that fit that athlete and their movement style. I also think I had a podcast episode with Jonas Dodu, who said, I think he had mentioned he had gotten away from the pushers and pullers a little bit and moved into force versus speed, which is I would say is a little bit of a simplification, but it's one that kinetically I think you can possibly have a bigger influence over. And the research is kind of coming out now saying how do we approach athletes from that perspective. If an athlete produces a lot of force, we need to train them more on the speed end and vice versa. And I know for team sport athletes, absolutely. I guess when we're talking about 100-meter specialists at the Olympics, I still don't know. But I think JB Marin's a really, really smart guy, and he's totally on the right track. So I'm always looking forward to what he has to say. I'm always looking forward to what Stu has to say. And I'm excited to see how that pushes forward. So those are just a few thoughts there. More so thoughts and ruminations more than hard facts. And this is what you should do. Things that I've learned. But hopefully that's helpful to you. And that's the last of the questions on the podcast today. So thanks everyone for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed it and the various questions. Thanks for everyone who asked a question. And that's it's been a pleasure doing this podcast with you guys today. Don't forget to visit our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end training technology such as the Freelap, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. They also have a new product out, RunScribe, really cool stuff. So check their site out, simplyfaster.com. We'll be coming at you guys next week with another great guest, getting back on the train of the great guests we've had on this show. We'll see you guys then.